You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. I'm your host, Paul Bestel. On today's episode of Mysteries and Monsters, we take a trip to the paranormal locations held within the Gopher State's borders. Our guide on this journey into the weird is our good friend Chad Lewis, as we dive into his new book, Paranormal Minnesota. We're on the hunt for haunted hotels, who host terrified guests, encountering some of their ghostly residents. We meet the Vampire of Winona, which shows us that such beliefs still permeate well into the modern era. A quick trip to Lake Wendigo is next on our itinerary, as we scour the area for deadly flesh-eating creatures, and then we wrap up with one of the strangest and most compelling UFO cases of all time. As always, it's a pleasure spending some time in Chad's company. But before that, don't forget you can support Mysteries and Monsters on Patreon by going to patreon.com/mysteriesandmonsters. Or you can click on the link in the show notes as always. $4 a month gets you ad-free, guaranteed early release episodes, bonus content, and much more. Mysteries and Monsters is also on all social media platforms, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, LinkedIn, and please subscribe to our channel on YouTube. You can also visit mysteriesandmonsters.com for news, episodes, and merchandise. A big thank you as always to Dean Bestall for his wonderful and consistently fabulous artwork. The show is produced by Brennan Storr of the Ghost Story Guys, and Mysteries and Monsters is delighted to be a part of the Straight Up Strange network. Now, let us head out on the hunt for mysteries, monsters and more in the company of Chad Lewis and Paranormal Minnesota. The land of 10,000 lakes is a cultural melting pot of peoples and customs from all over the world, alongside the lore of the native tribes. It's a state steeped in mystery, with vast tracts of forest. Yet there's other things lurking in the shadows. And in his new book, Paranormal Minnesota, Chad Lewis collects some of the Gopher State's creepiest, weirdest, and strangest legends and stories. Chad, glad to see you've survived the Hodag Festival. Welcome.
Thanks, and greetings from the Northwoods here in America.
Always a pleasure to speak to you, my friend. And like I said there, I'm very pleased that the Hodag didn't take you down.
There were some rumors that the Hungry Hodag was the cause of my demise, but luckily I was able to fend it off and I survived and ready for the next one.
Absolutely. There'll be a few cryptids around the States sharpening their claws as we speak, no doubt, Chad. I suspect the Van Meter mystery may be planning something later in the year for you.
Yes, every year I put out some life insurance when I go to Van Meter, expecting for it to be my end. But knock on wood, you know, I've done, I think, 8 years of festivals there and I've survived. I can't say that for everyone else, but I have survived.
Oh, well, your new book, as I said in the introduction, Paranormal Minnesota, is one of those lovely collections that I really appreciate, because it's a book that's collected a variety of encounters and witnesses and stories about a variety of topics. It's not just ghosts. And I know, as before we started, we were talking about how the term paranormal seems to have become shoehorned only to deal with ghosts and spirits these days, Chad. And yet here we have Paranormal Minnesota book, and you've got stories about cryptids and lake monsters, and there are obviously quite a few hauntings in there, but it's not just ghosts, is it?
It really isn't. And when I first started out in this field long ago, I remember when I was just getting into it, when Jerome Clark's Unexplained book came out. I think it came out in 93, and I was blown away because it was one of those books where one night you could read about fairies and the next little chapter was on crop circles and then ESP and things falling out of the sky and weird lake monsters. it was just, you never got sick of it because it was always changing. And I had done tons of books on specific stuff, like just creatures of a state or UFO sightings or hauntings. But I really wanted to go back to that feeling of every chapter was something new and something bizarre.
Yeah. And I think when you're a reader, it's sometimes it can be hard going if it's a book on one particular subject. Obviously, if you're deeply interested in Sasquatch or hauntings or something, then it's you're going to be okay with choosing a book in that regard. But I agree. I think too many books these days have kind of lost this myriad of mysteries that they used to collect together. I love those old books that you used to be able to get. Reader's Digest were fantastic in collecting weird and wonderful stories and just putting them in this enormous compendium that would give you arm ache when you try to read them.
I think today, if you ask most people that of our certain age, how they got involved and how they really started liking the paranormal, it was probably through those books you just mentioned, the Time Life and the Reader's Digest, where it would just be a hodgepodge of all these different paranormal phenomena. And they would just be so fascinating. And, you know, I love stories of Bigfoot and other creatures, but when you start to get 30 of them in one chapter, you know, 30 different sightings, they kind of blend together. Whereas these old books, you certainly knew one night when you were on vampires and the next night you were on chupacabra, you were in different territory.
And it keeps your wits about you. You've got to be prepared for any eventuality in those kind of circumstances.
And it also, I think, expands your interest, expands the spectrum. Mm-hmm. As we were talking about how so many paranormal investigators do nothing but ghosts and haunted research, which is fine if that's what they like. But I think these books really expanded the entire spectrum and got you interested in saying, whoa, I didn't know about this. Now I'm interested.
It is interesting because, like you say, my interpretation of the paranormal is it's an all-encompassing term. Whereas these days, if you say, well, I'm really into the paranormal, people will automatically assume that you're just into ghosts. So it's, for me, I like how the fact that the term Fortean seems to have risen in prominence as well, Chad, which seems to have kind of superseded paranormal with it going into the spirit realm, as it were.
Many people are now saying they're more into Fortean subjects or areas of high strangeness, where it incorporates all of these different aspects. Again, where, you know, when I first started out, I was really interested in UFOs. I joined the Mutual UFO Network. I went to one of the UFO hotspots near my hometown interviewing people. And that's what I was really interested in. But yet at the same time, I loved sea serpents. I loved hauntings. I loved stories of ESP and telepathy. So I think a lot of people tend to focus and become specific in one field, which is fine. But then there are others of us who really like the whole area of the paranormal. And it's always expanding as well when we're getting new legends and new folklore and then digging up old folklore as well.
Always reminds me of when I spoke with Tony Healy, the Australian researcher, a few months ago, Chad. He was on about when he went to Bluff Creek, ground central for Bigfoot, as it were, in the modern era. And whilst he was there, people were telling him about sea serpents and mysterious black panthers turning up and strange lights. And he was like, well, have you told anybody else about this? And he said, oh, yeah, we tell everybody that comes, but they're only interested in Bigfoot.
Yeah, I find that a lot, that many of these areas seem to be, as John Keel would call them, window areas or portals or paranormal beacons, where you get all sorts of different anomalies happening in a certain area. But if you go in there only asking about one certain topic, oftentimes people will only tell you that. If you go to a place and say, oh, have you heard of any Bigfoot sightings? They're not usually going to say no, but there's a haunted house down the road. You know, they're going to answer, no, I'm sorry, I haven't. But if you open it up to just weirdness and folklore, it's amazing of how you can jog people's memories of what's weird in their own backyard.
I think that often gives certain areas that are known as window areas, Chad, as well. It seems to raise these areas to prominence. But for people like us that love Bigfoot and ghosts and strange black panthers and river monsters and strange stories of gnomes and elves hiding out in the forests, when we come across these areas, it's interesting that places like the Bennington Triangle and
The Bermuda Triangle, these areas seem to be more well known as being a triangle area or a portal, as you say, or an area of high strangeness. And yet, for the lovers of the weird like ourselves, they're all over the place, aren't they?
They really are. I can't think of any one specific place that's known for something like Roswell or Mothman that doesn't have other phenomena going on with it. It might not be as prevalent and it might not be as well known or publicized, but it's happening. For instance, last time I was in Loch Ness, which at this point has been many years ago, I was talking to more people who believed they had seen UFOs over the loch than I was talking to people who had seen Nessie or a sea serpent. They were seeing odd things. So I think it's when you're collecting all of these, you tend to, you know, gather more than somebody on the straight and narrow. And also, just as a researcher or investigator, that sometimes you get bored and sick of things for a while. You know, I've done a book on Wisconsin lake monsters. And at that time, there were over 40 different lakes, rivers, and streams that were said to have had or have a giant leviathan of the deep in them. And by the time I was done with that book, I needed something different than lake monsters. You know, I was fed up. I was done with lake monsters enough. I survived. Now let's move on and see what, you know, thunderbirds are doing.
Well, that is the one benefit of loving it all.
It is. And I can't tell you how many cycles I've gone in over the last nearly three decades I've been doing this. As I mentioned, you know, starting out, my main interest was UFOs, and then it shifted to hauntings and then to mysterious creatures and back and forth between five, six different things all the time. And I think that helps bring the longevity, that not getting burned out is a very common thing in this field for people to get burned out for several reasons. One, I think they try to get too specific of a general area, but two, they come into the field thinking, oh, I'm going to solve these questions. I'm going to answer them. I'll find the answers. I'll figure out what this is doing. And all of a sudden you realize you have no idea what's going on, or at least in my case, you know, that I'm more questions than answers. And that if you go into the field thinking you're going to have all the answers, I think you burn out very quickly as well.
Yeah, very true. And obviously, as you well know, Chan, certain things like ghost hunting and things can be damn boring at times, where you basically can be sat about for 6 or 7 hours and nothing happens. And eventually, if you're doing that day in, day out, it will take its toll and it'll kind of tarnish your enthusiasm for the subject, no doubt.
Too many people watch the TV shows thinking all the sexy parts are going to be the fun and exciting parts.
Yeah.
They don't show all the research that goes into it. Like you said, sitting around for 7, 8 hours, nothing happening. Which is why I think early on I shifted from, again, trying to figure out proving or disproving these things to the adventure of it, of having fun there and seeing it as the adventure and getting to know these places, the visiting the roadside attractions, hitting the back roads, all of that makes it one big adventure. So if you do go to a haunted graveyard and nothing happens, you're still going to have fun. You're looking at the historical markers in the graveyard. You're stopping at places on the way there. So I think it, again, adds to the longevity of being in this field.
Absolutely. I think if you've got an appreciation for history and the landscapes, especially in certain states in the US, Chad, then you're never going to be bored. Even as you say, if you go there hunting for ghosts and they don't turn up, then you've got a whole world of history at your fingertips, and you can find out all kinds of things about places you would never have visited if it wasn't for a particular UFO sighting or a Bigfoot encounter or a supposed ghostly graveyard.
And it goes the exact opposite way too. I've had so many people tell me that they go to these supernatural places, but they're really more interested in the history of the place. And they just use this as a diving spring board to dive into it. Or they love architecture and they love going to alleged supernatural buildings just to see the architecture. So I think there's a lot of different areas in this field, not just the folklore and the legends themselves.
I think when I started reading your latest book, Paranormal Minnesota, you've got that wonderful foreword by the marvelous Sean Engelman, who's responsible for the wonderful Creepy Acres, which is, as he says, he's famous for a puppet show where Bigfoot tells
fart jokes, which was one of the highlights of the last 2 years, was discovering Sean's work. And I found it very interesting that he was kind of describing how Minnesota seems to be a state that doesn't sort of shout about its freaky happenings. It seems to be very sort of quiet about all the weird stuff that's gone on. For someone who's got so much time, because I know you spent a lot of time in Minnesota over the years, Chan, it's clearly a place close to your heart, along with Wisconsin. Is it one of those aspects of certain states in the US that some of them are quite shy about the weird things that have gone on in their history?
Minnesota's really odd in the fact that they don't play up their weirdness as much as here in our neighboring state of Wisconsin. And I spent a decade living in Minnesota, and I think they publicize a lot of other things. Obviously, their lakes, their recreation, they're fantastic, maybe the best in the world at promoting their Paul Bunyan and Babe the Blue Ox history. Mm. But a lot of their supernatural places are just starting to realize that it's a tourist boom and a tourist draw to go to these places, that for years they were, I think, operating under the wrong assumption that people aren't interested in this stuff. And if they hear about it, they're going to stay away rather than come visit. So I think Minnesota is just a few years behind. And there's something also about being from the Midwest, not wanting to brag, not wanting to self-promote. And when you're waiting for others to promote you, other states aren't going to jump in and say, oh, everyone in Illinois should go to Minnesota instead of spending your money here. I mean, there's no one who's going to do it for you. So Minnesota just has to get over that Midwest niceness and start presenting themselves, maybe tying it in with Paul and Babe.
Yeah, I mean, it is one of those strange things that happens, I think, sometimes, as you say there. You know, other states aren't going to tell you to go to Minnesota, so somebody's got to do the job for themselves. And you get certain areas of that aspect of it here in the UK. There are certain cities that live on the fact that they will tell you they are the most haunted city in the UK, which is usually ends up being an argument between York and Edinburgh, Chad. But there are other cities that have long histories. Manchester is one that doesn't seem to talk about its paranormal history, despite it having a well-established long history. And there are some incredibly strange cases from the Manchester area. And yet, unless you go there and you know where to look and what to say, you're not going to uncover them. Whereas Liverpool's very sort of forward in sort of pushing itself and its weird history and its ghostly happenings. So I'm still surprised, because there's someone that's got to know your work and knows a couple of things that have happened in Minnesota over the years, I'm still surprised that they seem so reticent about shouting from the rooftops that there are some amazingly strange things that have happened here.
I really feel that wherever these legends originate from, there has to be somebody there living there full time that loves it and is going to take it on as their own pet project. And that's the way a lot of these legends really start to sprout, is that people start taking pride and they really embrace their history of the area they live in. And that's getting a bit harder to do here in the States, as people are so mobile now that they're moving a lot. It seems like nobody is born, raised, and dies in the same town without ever living 10 different places. So I think sometimes when people are on the move so much, you don't get that long-term history of a place, where you pull into a small town and see that stereotypical old man sitting on the bench by the general store, and you sit down next to him and he can speak for 10 days about the history of the town. You just don't find that as much. So I think you really need somebody there on the boots on the ground that love the legend and are willing to promote it.
Absolutely. Well, I think if you're going to go to Minnesota and do some investigating, Chad, probably the first place I would recommend going on your book, and no doubt as someone that's spent plenty of time there, is perhaps booking a trip to stay at the Palmer House Hotel, which has a long history of very spooky encounters.
The Palmer House is in this quaint little town in northern Minnesota. The downtown makes you feel like you're back in the 1920s and 30s. And again, it's one of those things where most people know about it because it's the boyhood home of novelist Sinclair Lewis. But the Palmer House sits like a remnant of the early 1900s, where you feel transported when you go back there. And it's probably one of the best examples I can think of a hotel capitalizing on its weird history and haunted stories, that they not only are willing to talk about it, they have events there, they're letting investigators there, they're doing the full nine of promoting this. And for them, it's been a real boom. I talked to them about how many people, what percent of people do they think are there because of the haunting? And they told me upwards of 80%. So you start thinking, take away 80% of your customers, I don't know how many businesses could survive.
And the thing about the Palmer is, often when you have a hotel that's renowned for being haunted, it's usually a specific room or the cellar, or perhaps strange things happen in the restaurant. Whereas the wonderful thing it seems about the Palmer is, doesn't matter where you stay or where you go, the spirits like to sort of wander around.
That's the exact truth there. And that's why when people call the Palmer and say, what room should I stay in? What's the haunted room? And they say, you can stay in any room, because activity seems to happen everywhere, from the private rooms that you get to down in the cellar, which was mainly used for storage. It's a dirt floor in some parts, very creepy and dark and old. They could have a real haunted house with costume people down there because it's that creepy. Or you can sit in their magnificent ground floor bar and restaurant, and weird things happen there. You know, bartenders report things flying across the room, thrown by some unseen force. But people in their room report, you know, the covers being thrown off of them, knocking and rapping on the doors and windows, items being moved around. So I love every time I stay at the Palmer, I'm in a new room that I haven't been in, just because there's that possibility that things are going to happen everywhere. Whereas some of these other haunted hotels around the world, you have to make sure you get in, you know, room 304. And if it's booked, well, you're out of luck.
Absolutely. Well, the Palmer as well seems to have several different spirits. I know one of the most famous ones is this alleged child that people report hearing the sound of it bouncing a ball around, Chad.
And this goes back to the Palmer House really embracing these legends, where they built a little kids' play area in one of their small rooms, where obviously if you have kids staying at the hotel, they can play in there too, but mainly set up for the spirits of the young kids there. And one of the boys was thought to be getting medical attention at a nearby hospital and staying at the Palmer. And unfortunately, legend states that he didn't make it. He passed on. And he's often seen bouncing a ball through the hallway or running through the hallway like kids are prone to do, often late at night, where people will walk into the hallway thinking, who's out here bouncing a ball and playing? And nobody's there. And people who don't even know the haunted history of the place, upon checking out, will say, I loved my stay. It was great, but some kid was playing in the hallway all night, but I couldn't find who it was. So they would complain, not knowing that it's allegedly the haunted spirit.
And that's one of those ghostly apparitions or ghostly events, Chad, that seems quite harmless, really. It's just some child still enjoying itself, which is quite nice, I suppose.
I think people take comfort and solace in that some kid who life was cut short by an illness is still able in some form or some reality to continue on. And I don't know of many places that maybe they just don't want to publicize it, that have something that's terrifying and scary. Whereas a lot of B&Bs in America, bed and breakfasts, they actively state that these are good spirits, that they'll only appear if you want them to, or they often are beneficial or helpful, helping a guest find a lost object or getting back to their room. In Deadwood, South Dakota, there's the old Bullock Hotel, which is a world famous haunted place. And one guy was staying there with his grandson, and his grandson went to the vending machine to get some treats for the day, as you know, a lot of kids like to do at hotels. And it had been a while since he was gone, so his grandpa was just about to go look for him, and he opened the door, and the grandson was right in front of him. And the grandfather said, oh, where were you? What took so long? And the kid said, oh, I was turned around, Grandpa. This place is big. You know, I couldn't find my way back. But then this nice gentleman brought me back to my room. And the grandpa looked down the hallway each way. Nobody was there. Thought nothing of it. But the next morning while checking out, the grandson said, Grandpa, Grandpa, that's the guy who helped me out. And on the wall was a picture of Seth Bullock, who's obviously long been deceased. And it was, you know, the ghost of Bullock who went and helped the young boy back to his room. So sometimes there are those stories like that of something being helpful and fun and curious rather than terrifying and, you know, sinister.
Yeah. Well, there is another aspect of the Palmer, which seems to be, yes, it's all right if you don't mind ghostly children playing, Chad, but there's a wonderful story about a honeymoon couple who had an unwelcome visitor join them.
A lot of people spend their honeymoons in that area, and they want to go there if they're history buffs or just small town visitors. And one couple was there, and middle of the summer, when all of a sudden it was just ice cold in the room where the woman woke up, they were on their honeymoon. And at the edge of the bed, the foot of the bed, she saw what appeared to be a man that looked like he was straight out of the early 1900s. And she immediately grabbed her husband. What's going on here? And by the time he came to, the man was simply vanished. But she was absolutely positive she had seen someone at the end of her bed. And even though it was kind of frightening to her, it wasn't a frightening spirit where it didn't do anything threatening or didn't look like it was, you know, missing half its face or anything completely creepy. It was just standing there kind of hovering over, watching almost with curiosity rather than vengeance on its face.
It's still not what you need on your honeymoon, I suspect, Chad, regardless of its quiet sort of hovering around.
I think it's like all travel though, Paul, that at the moment, it probably threw them off. They didn't get a good night's rest. But I bet, guarantee, years later, that's the story they're telling from their honeymoon. It's like when you're traveling and you break down or some unexpected circumstance pops up. At the time, it's stressful. It throws you off. It might even ruin the day. But years later, you find that those are often the stories that keep being retold over and over because of what they were, that they were something unexpected. And for me, it's the same thing, that a lot of the stories I thought would be the most fun experiences turned out to be something completely different.
Yeah. I think, like you say, one of the strengths of the Palmer is its pride in what goes on there, because I think the lady that's the current owner, is it Kelly?
Yes.
She's clearly very interested and proud of what's going on, and she's not shy in sort of talking about it. And I was really interested in this strange incident that occurred in the restaurant area where there was this strange kind of material that seemed to appear from nowhere and upset a couple of diners.
Yeah, this woman and her husband would dine there quite a bit, and they were there and they reported some odd experiences, like feeling like something walked by them, like there was a spirit or something. And the husband went out to pay and get the car or whatever, and this woman stood up and she had all this weird dust like stuff, almost like laundry dust that you pull out of the dryer lint, all over her. But yet it was nowhere else around, on the floor, on the table. Yeah, she was covered in this, and they were so excited at the Palmer House, as weird as that sounds, that they took some samples of this and sent it off. And as of today, they don't seem to be able to figure out what exactly it is or was that seemed to cover this woman out of nowhere. And that's, I think, is really telling, because that's the sort of thing that happens at the Palmer House, that it's not your typical apparitions that are seen every time, but it's all that oddities of somebody walking up to the bar, ordering a drink, and then vanishing right before people's eyes, and people hearing somebody calling to them from down the hallway. But when they look, nobody's there. So not only does it happen everywhere at the Palmer, but it's such a wide variety of weirdness that it keeps everybody on their toes.
Absolutely. You don't know what's going to happen from one location to the next in the Palmer. And I suppose that's probably the best thing about it.
It really is. And I think with a lot of these places that when you go there, like the Palmer, if you go there and you spend the night, spend the weekend, and nothing happens, you're still left with a wonderful weekend at a cool historic spot. Like in Lake Pepin, Minnesota, there's a sea serpent called Peppy. There's a $50,000 reward offered for his capture. And one of the big promoters is a gentleman named Larry Nielsen. And Larry always states that when you go to Lake Pepin looking for Peppy, that if you don't see it, the worst that's going to happen is you're going to have a wonderful day at the lake. It's a win-win. You can't lose. And it really goes back to my idea of making this an adventure, that if you see it as an adventure of a day out on the lake, doing some fishing, you know, water skiing, whatever you're doing, that you won't be disappointed if nothing happens. If it does, it's a bonus, but yet you're going to be happy either way.
Absolutely. And once again, that's all about appreciating the location as well as the legends.
If you're going there specifically just for the phenomena, as we talked about, you're going to be disappointed 99% of the time, maybe more. But if you're going there for the adventure and the fun of it and trying to pick up pieces from other things to enjoy, you're going to have a blast and you're going to want to go back.
Mm. There is one thing that's always intrigued me about certain areas of the United States, and this is these occasional vampire flaps. Obviously, a lot of people will probably be very aware of the Mercy Brown case. It's probably one of the most famous instances of a modern alleged vampire problem occurring. And yet, Minnesota's also got one, which is quite a sad story as well, because it's one of those that it's fairly recent. I mean, it's just over 100 years ago since this awful story sort of came to light. And yet it shows us that even though we were in the 20th century, old superstitions were still so embedded in the local townsfolk and the people who were there.
Well, it takes us back to Winona, which is a river town on the Mississippi River, a small little place filled with immigrants in the early 1900s. You crazy Europeans came over here and brought your legends with you. And that's exactly what happened. And the reason I bring it up, because that is literally what happened. So in 1921, this is when the story takes place, but it was a few years prior to that, that the Block family was living on the east end of Winona in a very superstitious neighborhood when their daughter died, Frances Block. And soon after she died, every year, one of her brothers seemed to follow her to death. And finally, after several years of this, with four of his sons dying after his daughter, Mr. Block was down to just a couple daughters left and one son. And when that son took ill, neighbors said, "You have to do something. We know what's causing the death of your family. It's not illness. It's not disease and viruses. It's your daughter." And the belief was back then that coming over from the old countries, that the first kid to die in a family would then act like a vampire or psychic vampire and try to, like a siren, try to entice their siblings to follow them into death. So the neighbors told him that your daughter's killing your entire family. If you want to save the son, you need to do something. And that something is you need to go out to the graveyard, dig up your daughter's body and chop off her head and bury it separately from the body. And he was so distraught and at his wit's end because all of his sons were dying and his last son was on his deathbed. He was willing to try anything and he did it. He hired a neighbor to go out there at night and they dug up his daughter. But when they saw her, they realized that she was merely a skeleton and they thought she can't possibly be coming out of the grave in this condition and killing all of her siblings. So they reburied her and did not desecrate the body. But then the son the next day took another bad turn in his health. So they thought, well, let's go see if it's the second death in the family that's doing it. So they went back to the same cemetery and dug up the first son to die. And they found him in the same condition, almost completely decomposed. And they reburied him and did not desecrate that body. But the police then found out about it and they wanted to see if he really did go out there and, you know, molest the body. So they went out there and dug up the daughter and found that the head had not been severed, but interestingly, they found that the body had a white cross on its chin, that there was an indentation of a white cross that had been placed there at her funeral on her chin. And that was a telltale sign of vampirism, that if you were afraid of a loved one coming back as a vampire, you could put a little cross or crucifix on their body to keep them grounded in the cemetery.
Mm-hmm. I think it's remarkable as well. One of the things that I found really interesting about this particular case, Chad, is that the fact that it wasn't illegal to dig up a body, illegal to dig up a body in 1922. It was one of those where they were trying to find out if Mr. Block had actually committed a crime, and he hadn't, because he hadn't had the nefarious plans, and obviously he hadn't desecrated the corpse. So essentially, he just had dug it up and left it alone. So clearly, unless he had done what he originally told to do by some superstitious neighbours, then he would have been in trouble. But that made me smile, thinking that, you know, that's not normal behaviour, and yet he's not broken the law, so you can't charge him with something.
That's my favourite part of the story, outside of her possibly being a vampire, is the fact that, yeah, they consulted all sorts of city attorneys and lawyers. They wanted to charge him, and he was a former police officer, but yet they wanted to charge him for this. But apparently in the early 1920s in Minnesota, you could dig up as many bodies as you wanted, as long as you didn't harm them. There was no law on the books. And whenever I tell this story lecturing in Minnesota, I warn people that it probably has changed now. They're trying to dig up people in your graveyard, because there probably are some laws on the books now, but back then they just kind of went, oh, don't do it again then.
Well, I suppose it's one of those things, Chad, that unless it happens, you don't usually write, because you can only write so many laws. So you would presume that nobody in their right minds would go rummaging around a graveyard in the depth of night trying to dig up a corpse that they might think is a vampire.
And here in the United States, this was just several years before Prohibition hit. You think of the roaring 20s and the 30s of the gangsters and Prohibition, yet these old world beliefs were still prevalent in Winona at that time, that this gentleman didn't want to do it. He was heartbroken, but he had no choice, because his neighbors were so superstitious, they were blaming him for not doing something. And I think the tragedy of all this is that after he dug up his daughter and his son and didn't go through with it, which saved him probably jail time or at least a fine, it caused the death of his last son that did not recuperate and died. And the father believed if he had gone through with it, his son would still be alive, that perhaps he wishes he would have done it.
It's remarkable, because they all succumbed to tuberculosis as well, didn't they, his children?
They did, but again, hard to blame science when you're bringing these old beliefs and these old superstitions with you. Mm. And they're from the old countries and they have a long history. Science was new, relatively new at that time. So what are you going to believe? What you've known for the last several hundred years, or these fancy scientists telling you there's nothing you can do to stop it? So they were very superstitious in that neighborhood of, you know, mostly immigrants. There was a lot of Polish people there and other European countries that came, and they brought their own beliefs and their own medicine with them.
I know as you were covering this in the book, I know you and Kevin went and visited the actual graveyard. And it's quite interesting, as I was saying earlier on, there's clearly a couple of more well-known stories in the US that are based on an alleged vampire rising from the grave to terrify their remaining relatives, Chad. And when you went there, you were speaking to a member of staff, and they didn't know anything about it, which is strange. But do you think, as we were talking at the beginning of this conversation, where we were on about Minnesota being quite sort of reticent about talking about its paranormal history, that once again, this is one of those that it's a bit of a strange story? Do you think they just perhaps wanted it to stay in the past, and it's only sort of the last 20, 30 years that people like ourselves have discovered this weird legend? Well, not legend, this real weird activity that went on with the Block family.
I think perhaps in those days, you know, cities were very conscious of how they portrayed themselves, that they wanted to be this new city where things were bustling. Remember, in the U.S. at that time, cities were competing with one another. Population growth was thought to be a great thing. The more people you have living in your community, the better, the more industry, the more jobs, the more fun you'd have there. So I think maybe Winona was looking at this as just kind of a bad omen on their record, if you will, that we don't want to be known as these gullible, superstitious people. Let's forget about it. And then, of course, just a few years later, they had more to worry about because Winona became a real hotbed for prohibition activity. At one time, it was said that Winona had many, many dozen brothels, speakeasies, and the like. So they shifted very quick from these old world beliefs to breaking the law during prohibition, which outlawed, obviously, drinking and spirits.
Yeah. It is interesting at that period of time when you look, because primarily because the states were so close to the Canadian border, Chad, that's why these anti-prohibitionists were so drawn to these northern states, because obviously Illinois, Wisconsin, and Minnesota all have histories of being well-known hotspots for people who were desperate for a bit of drink during these dry prohibition eras.
And in Winona, they had a place called the Unlucky Seven. It was a speakeasy that had been raided 7 times by prohibition agents. And it was so much that, again, all of these immigrants, all of these travelers from the old countries, they believed that prohibition was wrong, that they had a right to their wine, their spirits, and their drink. And so much so that when the federal government pulled into Winona in a bus, you know, a bus looking to make arrest, townspeople started throwing rocks and chased them out of town. So the federal government comes in to clamp down on prohibition, and the people of Winona said, nope, started throwing rocks and chasing these agents who scurried for their lives out of Winona because they really didn't believe in prohibition. That, you know how Europe is, where it's a right. You know, try going over to any country in Europe and saying, no more drinking, close down the pubs. You're probably going to be exported very quickly.
Yeah, that was the one thing about the pandemic here, was the amount of people who ended up building their own bars in their homes, because they couldn't go to the pubs here in the UK. So yeah, that wouldn't last very long, I suspect, if anybody tried something similar here.
So the Winona thing, yeah. So Kevin and I, Kevin Lee Nelson, a co-author and fellow researcher I've done a lot of projects with, we went there, and because this is a relatively new case for me as well, that it's only in the last 5 to 10 years where I heard about this. And I have in-laws in Winona, so luckily I'm there all the time researching.
Mm.
And we went there and talked to some of the staff members, and they had no idea. Now, normally if you go to a cemetery that has a pretty infamous burial there, when you go in and say, you know, can you tell me where the cursed chair is? They'll say, C5, there's a marker, you won't miss it. You know, they're so accustomed to it. But this one, she had never heard of the Block family, had to look it up for quite some time here, finding where it was and who was buried there, and had never heard the vampire story. But when we started asking her if she had ever experienced anything weird, she had a couple odd experiences, one of which she would not even tell us because she thought it would spark new activity, that she wasn't going to tempt fate. You know, when you talk about the weird comes looking for you type stuff. So one case, she wouldn't even tell us what happened because she had to work there every day. And she said, you don't, which means Kevin and I didn't work there. We didn't have to come back there the next day and deal with whatever was going on with her, but she did.
It is interesting how you meet people like that who have had a paranormal encounter, Chad, and they just don't want to really talk about it because they think it might encourage a return visit.
Believe it or not, it's hard to comprehend that not everybody is passionate and interested in these things, that some of them would rather not even deal with it and go about their lives. And it is that belief that just talking about it brings it forward, or at least it puts it in your consciousness and maybe gathers it around you and attracts it. So what's fascinating to me is that she didn't even want the one experience where she saw this weird light moving through the graveyard. She didn't even want to investigate it and look into it and try to come up with any explanation. She just kind of went, that's weird. Let's leave that out there. I've got work to do.
So is it one of those stories that you think now, do more people visit it? Obviously, as you say, you've got family there now, Chad. Has it sort of caught attention of modern legend trippers and things like that, that this people now visit this graveyard primarily because they've heard this story in recent years?
I believe so. A lot of people contact me asking for exact directions to their graves, to the Block family gravesite. So I think people are going there. I don't think it's to the level of like Roswell or, you know, Mothman, but people certainly make the trek there. And local media picked up on the story, which was covered in their newspapers, you know, the same newspapers they work at. They republished a lot of it recently. So I think that has garnered a lot of attention. And I think it's just one of those really fun and cool and maybe sad stories, as you mentioned, that deserves a little more sunlight on it than, cause it was hidden, at least from me, you know, for almost 100 years.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's interesting when you find these stories. And like you say, a lot of these local newspapers and things, because Halloween and the supernatural seems to be really popular, a lot of places sort of in October now, Chad, and obviously Minnesota is quite famous because there's a small town there called Anoka that claims to be the Halloween capital of the world. So it's clearly a state that loves its spooky goings on. So for a lot of them, they've started this sort of trend of republishing these old articles. So that's probably another driving force, as you refer to there. And I would imagine there's plenty of little towns all around the US that have started to sort of dig into their archives.
I'm really worried that when newspapers finally go out, which I hope they never do, we're going to lose a lot of sources of this stuff that's happening right now. That as more and more newspapers that are surviving, I think they're turning more local, that they're not covering as much of the national stuff because you can get that anywhere and newspapers are behind the times of CNN and all the other channels. So they're focusing more on local stuff, and that includes legends. And for me, I think that's the type of stuff that's going to save the small independent newspapers, is putting the stuff that you can't get anywhere else. And if you look at where a lot of these legends that are so well known in America come from, it's from old newspaper accounts, somebody actually documenting it in the old days. So I often worry about what's going to happen with legends that are propping up today when there's no newspaper of note to cover them.
That is a concern. I agree. I completely share your concern in regards to that aspect of it, because it's one of those things, I think, that it's not something a lot of places and a lot of publications do over here in the UK, Chad, as well, which is a real shame. There are certain places, as what we were saying, Cornwall and Norfolk, that seem to be very proud of their strange history and like to promote it in their local media and online and such like. And yet, where I live in South Yorkshire, there are a couple of very well-known cases of poltergeists and UFOs that, unless you know about them, you've really got to dig them out. There was a really famous poltergeist case in a town called Barnsley in the 70s, which featured a dancing walking stick, Chad, that would tap out tunes for people. And it was centered around a young lad who was bedridden for about a year. And people would come into this pub and they'd watch this dancing walking stick, and people checked his bedclothes and made sure that there was no strings or anything. It was on television and it was in certain newspapers. You can't find any articles in the local press about it these days.
That seems absurd, that a walking stick on its own and nobody's covering it?
Yeah, precisely. It's a fabulous story.
Oh, that's crazy. At first, when you mentioned it, I thought you were talking about the 1870s.
No, it's 1970s. Yeah, it's about 50 years ago, if that.
Wow. Yeah, that's amazing that nobody's documenting that and it's just sitting there. And again, you and I, and the many times we've done these chats, we've talked quite a bit about how some legends just seem to get all the publicity and the marketing, and they're so well known, yet there are other cooler, more bizarre legends like the walking stick that you never hear of, and they're just vanishing.
Absolutely. It is. I will send you the link later, Chad, and you can have a look, because there is a fabulous sort of 5-minute video interview with the young lad and the people that actually checked his bedroom for everything. So I'll send you that and you can have a look at that. And if you need any help deciphering what people are saying, then just let me know and I'll convert it into Queen's English for you.
And I love the idea of back in the old days, from the 1800s all the way up to even to mostly modern times, people tried to find a hoax that, as you said, they were checking the bed, checking for strings, ropes, pulleys. That was common in those days to try to solve it. They didn't just poo-poo it. They said, okay, well, this is happening. Let's just rule out that it's this, this, and this. oftentimes, they would sleep at these alleged haunted places to see what was going on. Mm-hmm. So you'd get these old alleged haunted homes in the early 1900s with 20 townsfolk sleeping on the front lawn just to see if at midnight or 1 a.m. people are going to knock on the door, that type of thing.
Yeah, absolutely. You've got to try and rule it out. But it is, they seem to sort of think, oh, well, we'll prove this nonsense by just staying there. So it is strange when you look back sometimes.
And we have to remember, entertainment choices back then weren't as numerous as they are today. So townspeople often, news spread through the town and the whole town would be riled up over it and looking to solve it. Like it was a mystery for the whole town to get involved with.
Oh, absolutely. I've read several poltergeist cases from sort of the late 19th century, early 20th century from both the UK and Australia, Chad. And as soon as everybody in the town knows, there's like 100 people stood outside this house or just walking in going, "All right, I've come to see this poltergeist you've got." And you're like, "Hang on, what's going on here?"
Well, let me ask you, why do you think poltergeist activity was so prevalent 100 years ago, 120, and today you don't hear as much about any cases of it?
That is something, because if you have to pin me down about the supernatural and ghosts, poltergeists are something I absolutely love. I love these cases. And it is something that I've been thinking about, that we haven't had a really big poltergeist case for probably 20 years, either in the US or over here, Chad. I agree, because obviously, you know, you had some really major cases in the 70s and 80s in the US. The Entity case is probably one of the most famous ones. And here we had the Enfield poltergeist and things like that. And yet, over the last 20 years, they don't seem to be really reported. And I'm not really sure if it's down to the fact that I would imagine they're probably still happening. But for me, I think when they look at the people that were the witnesses and that came forward, and the treatment and the disdain a lot of them suffered from investigators and the press and things, I think a lot of people are kind of not very keen in coming forward these days. That's my personal opinion anyway.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, just as you were talking about that, I was wondering if there's something about today's modern home that, you know, because a lot of poltergeist activity outside of things moving were a lot of noises, strange noises, where today people have their headphones on, they're watching Marvel movies on their 80-inch screen blasting, where they hear a noise and they say, who knows what that could be? Probably the neighbor starting their car. Where, you know, in the old days, it was so quiet and you had no distraction. So if all of a sudden you heard knocking on the wall, that was going to grab your attention. But today, who knows? I don't know. Just a theory.
Yeah. No, that is interesting. Perhaps it was, yeah, like you know, and as you say, entertainment choices were quite low as well. And a lot of people in the evenings, they would be spending more time at home. They'd go to work and then all the family would be together most of the time. So yeah, that is an interesting aspect. I don't know. I think that deserves more research, Chad. We need to try and find some new poltergeist cases and drag them into the light, I think.
I agree. And I wonder if anyone's done any research as when the poltergeist movies came out, if more people started reporting it around that time.
Yeah. Because often cultural things like that do sort of make people more confident in coming forwards, as well as obviously more people try and hoax things. And obviously, that would be interesting. Yeah. Because that's what, showing my age. Now, that's 40 years ago. It's 1982. I remember that film being one of the few as a child that really scared me. I watched it in the daytime as well, and it still frightened me.
Did it? It got you?
It did. It's that clown. Well, I think another aspect of Minnesota we need to touch on, obviously, was our very first conversation, Chad, back in 2020, which seems like 5 minutes ago these days. And I spoke with yourself and Kevin about your wonderful Wendigo book. And obviously, Minnesota is synonymous in regards to the Wendigo because of this wonderful lake that's on an island in a lake, which I believe is Lake Windigo, is it not?
It is. And it is that anomaly of a lake being on an island in another bigger lake, which it was featured in Ripley's Believe It or Not cartoons back in the early 1900s as being the lake within a lake. So it has some notoriety for that as well.
Yeah. So for you, obviously, as a lover of the weird and the wonderful, what was it that sort of piqued your interest about the Wendigo? Because once again, we've got what some people would simply dismiss as folklore, Chad. And obviously, we've done a really big episode this back on episode 79, which is unbelievable thinking about how far back that is now. But when we were talking about it, obviously, it's a subject that I learnt a lot of because obviously I've got family who live in Canada. So for me, it's something I've known about for quite a while. So when I read yourself and Kevin's book, I was deeply impressed with the level of research and the amount of historical data that we have. Because this is the thing about Wendigo cases. It was such an ingrained belief in the cultures on both sides of the border between Canada and the US that it simply can't be poo-pooed as just folklore, because these people really believed it.
They did, to the point where we have stories of people starving to death in their lodging because instead of going out to gather food and crops and game, they heard there was a Wendigo in the area. Not someone had been attacked by it, someone died, but just merely that there was a legend of a Wendigo coming, that rather than go out and face the Wendigo, they starved to death in their lodging because their fear of the Wendigo was so high. And I'm puzzled by the fact that the Wendigo is perhaps one of the oldest legends in North America, yet it's one of the least known legends as well. And when you dig into history and have hundreds upon hundreds of newspaper accounts of people killing one another because they thought that person was a Wendigo, how can this not be as ubiquitous as Bigfoot?
Yeah. And it's one of those as well, because it's something that's ingrained in the tribal lore of a few tribes as well. This isn't something that you can kind of push off as just one particular tribe having these beliefs. Chad, a lot of tribes who lived in those areas all had the same belief in this creature, which is very interesting as well, because usually you don't get this kind of cross-pollination in different tribes. They all seem to, a lot of them have very distinct differences in their cultural beliefs and lore.
So you had all these tribes all through the span of Canada, the northern Great Lakes area of the U.S., the East Coast, the northern portion of the U.S., separated by vast distances, cultures, languages, beliefs. Sometimes all these people, whether they were the First Nations or the indigenous people here in America or the French missionaries or the trappers, all these people believed in a similar creature. Many times they were warring with one another. So it's not like French missionaries are heading 2,000 miles and telling the story and getting the belief started somewhere else. They all believed in these similar giant creatures that were, if anything, the embodiment of cold, the embodiment of winter and scarce resources, that during these times of intense starvation, when no game was found, no food was to be sourced, that's when you're at your weakest, mentally, physically, and spiritually. And that's when the Wendigo would often attack and either devour you or, worse yet, possess you and slowly turn you into a Wendigo. And a lot of those hundreds of newspaper accounts that I mentioned where people killed one another, a lot of times if people believed they were turning Wendigo, they begged to be killed because they did not want to harm their friends and family and kill and eat them. So they begged that they'd be killed before they went full Wendigo.
Mm. Would you say that Lake Wendigo is probably in the US side of the border, Chad? Probably the most notorious area that these legends and lore is attached to, because it does seem to be, other than most areas around the border in Canada seem to have a history of this, but in the US, would you say it's this particular place that seems to be the the heart, well, ironically, the heart of the Wendigo legend there.
And that's hilarious the way you put it, because the Wendigo's thought to have an icy heart. And indeed, the only way, one of the ways to kill it is to defrost its icy heart or cut it out. And yes, there are legends that Lake Wendigo is the last place they legally did a Wendigo dance, meant to, or backwards dance, where they would do everything backwards to try to drive off the Wendigo and other spirits. And of course, this was at a time in America where we were outlawing a lot of Native beliefs and trying to squash their culture and kill away not only the people themselves, but their culture, their traditions, their language, their beliefs. And so it was thought that this was one of the last places where that was performed for quite some time. And a lot of the historians believe that many thought the Wendigo was in the lake itself, that it used the lake like a kettle, that there are numerous stories of people walking around the edge of the lake where the Wendigo was said to snatch them in and they would drown and spend eternity in their watery grave with the Wendigo. And, you know, of course, skeptics say that this is just a cautionary tale. Parents would tell their kids to stay away from the lake so they don't drown. And, you know, perhaps some of it is attributed to that, but there's no doubt that they believed that a Wendigo was residing on this tiny little island and the lake itself.
Mm. It is interesting when you come across these Native stories and this tribal lore that there are certain places that seem to be magnets for danger, Chad. And this is clearly one of them, because there are numerous historical legends attributed to the area. I know there's that story about the tribeswoman who fell in love with a white settler and was brokenhearted when people said that she couldn't consummate the relationship. She went and drowned herself in there, and therefore people think that's created some kind of supernatural power to this area as well. And it just seems to be one of those particular areas in North America that the local tribes that lived in that area seem to have a real sort of respect towards the dangers that this particular area held, which is once again one of those aspects of these legends that, well, why would it be that area? That I'm sure there's probably more dangerous bodies of water in Minnesota as well.
The old legend is that people went to the island and bad things happened. Bad medicine would take place there. So they left it and said it was a island they would never return to. You know, that it was a bad omen, a place you would not want to be. And we think of these things as, well, that's just superstition from a long time ago when people didn't know any better. And I mean all peoples. And but yet today, I told this story, I think, when we talked about the Wendigo on the show, that I spoke just right down the road from Wendigo Lake. And I was doing a lecture on Minnesota creatures. And before the program, a couple elders came up to me and they said, "We hear you're going to be talking about a certain legend of a monster in the area." They wouldn't say what it was, but they said, "We would appreciate it if you would not mention it at all. Don't talk about it. Don't say a word about it."
Mm.
And of course, I was a guest on their land. So I said, "Of course, I'll take it out. Don't worry. I won't even say the first letter." And I always joked that those words had no sooner left my mouth than I saw their body language relax. That all of a sudden, all the tense stress in their bodies was gone because they knew I wouldn't say it. And they were so afraid that I would merely mention the name of the Wendigo and that would bring doom to the area. So I just thought it was one of the weirdest things I'd ever seen. I've never seen somebody, several people shift their body language and their, I don't know, aura, if you will. Like I did that day when I said, "Of course, I'm a guest on your land. You know, I'll do whatever you want." And I've never seen anything like that to this day.
Yeah. I think once again, like we were saying about the person that worked in the graveyard, as we were talking about the vampire story, Chad, it is interesting how some beliefs or some creatures, even the very utterance of their name is expected to bring them forwards. And it's remarkable how that still exists in the modern era.
So many people I talk to say, "We don't talk about this. If we do, we talk in codes or just kind of skirt around the issue," whether it's talking about, you know, the little people, the fairies, the gnomes, trolls, goblins, and the like, or the Wendigo, or when I was looking for the Tata Duende in Central America, it was the same thing of don't say that. Don't talk about it. Crazy American, don't do it. And I think that just shows that outside of the U.S. or major portions of the U.S. and Europe to some extent, people have a healthier respect for these legends. And maybe it's because they have a healthier respect for their own history and legends and superstitions and beliefs, that those have kind of been lost for a lot of us in the modern cities, that, you know, we'll no longer hang a horseshoe over the entrance of our door to ward off witches. But in other parts of the world, they still do.
Yeah, my mom's got one.
No way.
Yeah.
Does she have it like up, what you'd consider upside down?
Yes.
Yep. Huh. That's amazing.
Yeah. I think a couple of years ago it fell down and she was adamant that I had to come around and put it back up as quickly as possible.
And those old super, I love those. I love that, you know, people in the old days would believe that you, whatever entrance you came into a building, that's how you had to leave.
Yeah.
So you wouldn't take the good or bad energy of that building with you, that you'd leave it behind. So you would never walk into a pub in the front entrance and then dart out the side entrance and be gone, because that would bring bad luck. I love that these superstitions are not quite forgotten, at least not by all of us.
Yeah. I think the whole area as well seems very strange, because obviously when we spoke about the whole subject of the Wendigo, we were discussing yourself, Kevin, and Noah's trip out there, which I still find incredible. Chad, looking at that footage and the temperature that it was, and the fact that Kevin slept outside in a hammock holding an axe, it still makes me chuckle, because it's one of those things as well, when people say, oh, well, it's probably just people winding tourists up and things. You don't go there in the dead of winter to muck about, because it's the kind of area you could end up losing your life as well if you're not very careful, isn't it?
On the first night when Kevin was in his hammock, the next morning, my colleague Noah and I went out, and he was covered in snow on his hammock. And for a moment, we looked at each other and thought, I think he might be dead. And it really, then he started moving. But the night before, I had had a similar problem where I made a foolish mistake of not getting my clothes completely free of snow before I sat by the fire, which meant all the snow that had somehow gotten on my, you know, pants and socks and that melted. And it was all water, you know, wet. And when I went to go into my tent, you know, I had the choice of going to sleep with kind of wet clothing, which would freeze at night, and then you'd be stuck with like solid boards on your legs, or strip down to my underwear and try to put on new, dry, cold clothing. And I went with the cold clothing, but midway when I was stripped down to my underwear, I was panicked. I thought, I need to get dressed fast and get into that bag, because if I don't, I'm going to die out here. It was 30 degrees below Fahrenheit with a wind chill. We're hours away from hiking into a town in the middle of the night over a lake. So I was really panicked. I almost thought, if I don't do this quick, I'm just going to have to go lay by the fire and sleep out by the fire the whole night. And it's one of those where you learn very quickly that the elements are not to be messed with. And this was just a couple day expedition for us. The people of the old times, they were dealing with this 7 months out of the year with no modern conveniences. They didn't have a nice down sleeping bag and hand warmers in their gloves. So they were hardcore. So it gave me real perspective and a fresh look into how harsh the elements would have been.
It is, because Minnesota can catch you unawares in the winter, because it has had some record-breaking down. I think the lowest temperature is 60 degrees below that's been recorded in Minnesota.
Yeah, International Falls, Minnesota is known as the icebox of the nation because it gets so cold there. And it, I mean, it can catch you in your car if you have a blanket and your winter coat and gloves and a hat. You still can be put in danger. So I have so much respect for the early pioneers, the First Nations people that were able to survive this somehow in these harsh conditions. And then here in the winter in Wisconsin, about mid-January, I start complaining about how hard it is here. Meanwhile, you know, I have electricity, running water, heat, and nonstop entertainment options. You know, I have to slap myself and bring myself back into reality that life for winter has never been easier than it is today.
Absolutely. The most danger you put yourself in is building a snowman, probably, chap.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, here in Wisconsin, the worst that happens is people's drinks freeze up outside on that. Yeah, well, they'll put their brandy slush outside and it'll freeze up on them, where in the old days, you know, your life was on the line every night.
Mm. I think one of the other aspects of this whole area as well that I really find interesting is this interview that was done with a gentleman called Otis Marsh, Chad, who had one of them jobs that you think, goodness me, I don't know how you managed to do it living in such a remote place and with so many legends attributed to the area. Because he was the caretaker of well, there's some properties on the island that people used.
There's a lot of, well, not a lot. There's a smattering of cabins that are grandfathered in that people use one or two weekends a year in the summer. And his job was to be the caretaker. I mean, straight out of The Shining during the winter months when nobody dared come there. His job was to make sure the pipes didn't freeze, no animals got in and tore apart the place. And he wrote a book that talked about all the strange events of ghostly activity, from weird balls of light to vanishing people hanging from trees and all sorts of stuff, where he would turn off a light in a home and come back and it would be on. And he was the only one on the island and only one with keys, and all sorts of weird things would be misplaced and moved, almost like it was a trickster spirit. And this was happening at the same time when people feared the Wendigo. Again, one of these areas where just oddities seem to happen everywhere.
You have to ask yourself, Chad, as well, how much did he need that job?
You know, again, I think as hard as, Paul, as hard as it is for you and I to maybe see it back then, mm-hmm. a lot of people, especially men, a certain type, loved it. Whether they were lighthouse keepers or caretakers on winter seclusion, they were kind of those odd men that like to be by themselves.
Mm.
And, you know, they flourished in those situations. And for most of us, you know, it would drive us crazy. And maybe it did drive them crazy too, but there was a certain segment of men mostly that seemed to be born to live in that isolation and away from everybody. And they really loved it. Not to say that they didn't like it when people came there in the summer and they could socialize and have fun, but they liked the seclusion and the isolation during the winter months.
Yeah. That's the seclusion I can understand. And perhaps, you know, just a bit of downtime and plenty of good books to keep you going. Chad, it's the thing that keeps turning the lights on and leaving the doors and windows open and locked houses that worries me.
And again, a lot of these people were diehard old timers where they didn't believe in any of that stuff. You know, they weren't going to be spooked. They had their weapons with them. But today it just seems impossible not to get scared when everything's going crazy on the island and you're there by yourself with no telephone, no way to contact people. You know, it's the perfect conditions for a horror movie.
There's only so many times you can say to yourself, that's odd.
Yeah, that's true.
Well, I think the last incident I want to dive into, Chad, is probably one of my favorite UFO stories, and it happens to have happened in Minnesota. And this is, for me, one of those stories that's elevated primarily because of the occupation of the key witness. And this is the Warren UFO encounter, which involved a police officer named Val Johnson.
We tend to think of witnesses of being credible when they're trained observers. Firefighters, pilots, police officers, military, men and women that have been trained to observe. So when they have an experience, we tend to throw a lot of credibility on it, knowing that they probably are looking at every other explanation. And so when it happened to Val, who worked way up in the northern portion of Minnesota and outside of a small town called Warren, he was patrolling late at night on the outskirts when he saw weird lights start to descend toward him. And at first he thought it was weird that it might be a plane making an emergency landing. But he kind of threw that out as it made its way toward him so fast, and he thought it was going to hit him. So he just guns his automobile, hits the accelerator, tries to get underneath it before it comes down and lands on him. And he's driving what they thought was about 55, 60 miles per hour. And then the next thing he knows, he wakes up on the side of the road. 40 minutes later, the car swerved off the road. He's unconscious. He wakes up and realizes that the UFO is now gone, but his car is completely damaged. I mean, a headlight was broken. The windshield was cracked almost from the inside. A couple of the antenna were bent at weird angles, and he's suffering from this weird, like, welder's burn over his eyes and face. So when a colleague of his comes and finds him there, they think maybe he crashed and he wasn't wearing a seatbelt and he hit his head because he had a bump on his head and his eyes were all red and swollen.
Yeah. It's a very odd case because I know he's one of those people that's very steadfast in what happened to him, Chad. And I like the fact that he got a lot of attention because obviously as soon as the story broke, he kind of got out all kinds of solutions were put forward, including that he'd been drinking and crashed, even though there was no evidence of him hitting anything, that drug smugglers had landed on his car. Just all kinds of crazy stories. And yet he said, well, this is what's happened. And you can either believe me or you don't. I don't care.
That's exactly right. And I think what really sets this case apart from a lot of other UFO encounters with credible witnesses as well is that the town had the foresight to keep the vehicle, to actually investigate and try to figure out what happened to the vehicle. They kept it. They kept the broken headlight, the windshield. They had experts from the car companies there, not UFO researchers only, but experts from the car companies coming to assess the damage and figure out how it could have occurred, what happened. And Val Johnson didn't want to talk about it in the beginning, but then he started doing some publicity where he said, yeah, I don't care if anyone believes me. This is what happened. You can think I'm a liar or drinking and all that. I know what I saw and I can't explain it. And there were a lot of other oddities with the case, like the differences on the car dashboard clock. His watch was 14 minutes off from what the clock was, even though they were synced up at the beginning of his shift, which really throws another wrench into this weird scenario. And that the eye burns, where the doctor said it was like he had been exposed to bright lights or radiation, like welders will get their eye burns. And he had terrible headaches, and eventually it became too much for him, and he moved away from the area and did not want to talk about it at all.
And the other thing as well is that I know a colleague of yours spoke to him 3 or 4 years ago, Chad, almost 40 years after the event, and he was still saying exactly the same thing. At that point, you would say, well, maybe it's easy to come forward and say, yeah, it was a hoax, or yeah, it was an accident that got out of hand. But he didn't change his story. It's still the same.
And here's the odd synchronicity with this case where I'm concerned, where once Val moved out of the area, he moved around a bit, he eventually landed in my hometown in Wisconsin. That's where he's living right now. And my colleague interviewed him. And again, he said, I have no idea what I saw. I have no idea. I guess you'd call it a UFO because it was unidentified. It was flying and it seemed to be an object. But I think far too often we put too much pressure on these witnesses to have an explanation that they've encountered something that they can't explain. And that even those of us in the field for decades upon decades, we can't explain it. So how do we expect somebody who just had one weird occurrence happen to them to have any more insight than the rest of us have? And he stuck to his story the entire time. He's never changed it drastically. He's never embellished it or tried to make it more bizarre to get more attention. And it wasn't until a couple years ago, the TV show Fargo did a fictional TV show, kind of had that UFO sighting as the basis for one of their seasons, that it really dredged up a lot of this interest in the Warren UFO car. And my favorite part is, Paul, you don't have to take his word for it. You don't have to take my word for it. You can take your own word for it, because the car is still on display to the public at the local historical society's museum on their county fairgrounds. I've lectured several times right in front of the car about the weird story. And people would come up to me all the time and tell me UFO stories. Like, of course we believe him. I had a similar encounter that I can't explain during that time period too. So I was amazed at how many people in that area, which is a farming area and rural place where you would think it's not, you know, a hotbed for paranormal beliefs among the residents, but these people had experiences there. So I love that you can go and investigate it for yourself. They kept the car in the original condition and you can see it and, you know, decide what you think might have happened.
I mean, this is the other aspect of all this. I know some people at the beginning, I think one of his colleagues even thought that because he wasn't wearing a seatbelt, because in those days you didn't have to, which is remarkable if you're driving a police car at high speed, Chad, that he simply had an accident and banged his head. But there was no damage inside the car. All the damage was outside of the car. And it didn't match as if, because his aerials were bent out of shape as well as damage to the hood. And there was this kind of like bullet hole impact on the windscreen as well. So it just, it's very easy to kind of say, oh, well, he probably just had an accident. But that just doesn't explain the damage to the car because it just doesn't look like he's hit anything that they found either, because they didn't find anything at the scene that he could have hit.
That's right. There were no roadkill deer, you know, up in that area. You had a bear. There were no crash things of another car. If he had smashed in and the headlight would have been cracked and nothing that they found, simply just very bizarre. And they had those impartial experts coming to look at it that couldn't explain. They didn't think it was though he hit something in the traditional manner of, you know, you and I hitting a stop sign. Like you said, it seemed like the impact almost came from inside where it cracked the window from the inside. And a lot of the, they were even had a hard time replicating the bend in the antenna that they often found at that exact degree it would break, that they couldn't repeat it. So they were puzzled by it. And this was one of the, I think, one of the best researched cases for experts coming up right away that were there talking to the witnesses, not just Mr. Johnson, but also his colleagues, the people that came and found him and everyone else in the area. So it was a pretty big to do.
Would you say it's probably one of the best pieces of evidence in the UFO field? Because there's not many things that can match that, really, is there? That's still with us this day and age.
I would definitely say it is. We had a similar case in Wisconsin where an officer, George Wheeler, claimed he was hit by a beam of light and it zapped his car and blew out the spark plugs and the electrical wiring. And he was found slumped over his vehicle as well. And it aggravated his heart condition and he ended up dying sometime after, which he blamed on his UFO encounter. And others had experiences, but we don't have the car. You know, so I think that here we have solid evidence that something happened. What it was, nobody seems to be able to explain, where once you start looking at the evidence, him being hit by a UFO seems just as plausible as anything else people have put forward.
Definitely. Well, Minnesota certainly is a state that has something for everybody. As we were saying at the beginning, Chad, this book has all kinds of topics and scary stories from all kinds of different fields. And I know your next book, you're diving into another state with a long history of strange and spooky stories, which is going to be based around Illinois.
Yes, just south of me. I love Illinois stories. They have a long history. And just going back to the beginning of this interview, I'm just ticking through the topics we talked about. I think we've done a great job of doing those old, you know, Reader's Digest. We talked about UFOs, Wendigo, hauntings, vampires, lake monsters, all these cursed places. I think we've done a good job of the people that put those books together so long ago would be very proud of us. And I'm going to do the same thing in Illinois with another cast of weird characters and cryptids and hauntings and uniqueness that you won't find anywhere else in America.
Yeah. Is there any particular location in Illinois that you've always enjoyed going to, or one that you've been to more than any other, Chad?
For me, the place I think I love the most and the one I hate the most is a place called Death Curve in Cambridge, because it illustrates that sometimes the scariest monsters out there are human form. And it's a case of, I won't go into the details. It's not fit for radio, but let's just say a mother disposed of her 7 children before taking her own life. And she seems to be the origin of why this little rural bend in the road called Death Curve is so popular for people to go to. And for me, it's one of those where I love going there, but I'm always sickened when I go there because I know what happened there.
Mm-hmm. And Illinois, obviously, as we were touching on earlier on, has a long and varied, or shall we say, checkered history when it comes to the history of prohibition and gangsters and the likes. And there's plenty of alleged haunted locations in and around Chicago where certain spirits are still said to lurk around the shadows, reliving their glory days.
All of the biggest name gangsters of the day, from Al Capone to John Dillinger to Babyface Nelson, Elvin Creepy Carpus, Ma Barker and the boys, they were all there. And for me, the hardest part of doing these books is what to leave out, because sometimes I'll leave out cases that I've done before in other books or very popular cases, like in Illinois. I don't know if I'm going to include Resurrection Mary because she's so well known. She's in every other book about Illinois weirdness. But yet, at the same time, when I leave stories like that out because I think they've been done to death, people will contact me and say, why didn't you throw Resurrection Mary in there? So when you're doing one of these compendiums or these books of collection of different phenomena, it's a tricky subject of what to leave out and what to keep, because no matter what, you're going to make some people very unhappy.
Yeah. I suppose the other danger as well is, Chad, is what else can you add to something that's that well known?
Exactly. And for me, the Minnesota book is about 85% new cases I never did before. Hmm. And some of the, like the Lake Windigo, I included in the Windigo book, and the Palmer House I had in my Haunted Road Guide to Minnesota. So some are just so cool, you have to throw back in. But for me, I like to find out what's new. Maybe it's new to me even, but what's new that hasn't been found everywhere else that people can grab it and say, whoa, I never knew this one.
Yeah. And I suppose as well, the other aspect of all that is whenever you do a book like this, Chad, people will contact you with new stories and new experiences that you would never have come across otherwise.
That's my favorite part. I've been doing this nearly 30 years. I do nearly 200 lectures a year, and there's not one event that I do where I don't learn something new from somebody where they say, have you ever heard of this? And I've never heard of it. I thought I was pretty well acquainted with a lot of Midwestern legends, and nope, I'm not even at the bottom 50% yet. So that's the beauty of it, is that these things are always changing. There's new stories coming up, new events, new characters. And for me, that's the best part of knowing that I can do this, hopefully knock on wood, for another 50 years and still never run out of material.
Absolutely. So when's that book due out, Chad?
I'm going to look to have it out for the end of the summer, because then I'm getting my Winter Legends and Lore little monograph will be out by Christmas.
Ah, fabulous. Fabulous. Well, hopefully we'll get a chance to talk about either of those down the line, my friend. So before I let you go, where can everybody get a copy of your latest book, Paranormal Minnesota, and follow your work going forwards, my friend?
Obviously, any bookstore or online, or if you want it signed, go to my website. But if you want to find me, just go to the weirdest legend you can think of, and I'll probably be out there investigating it.
Or trying to get Joe or Kevin to touch some cursed object on your behalf.
Oh, those two are doomed. I don't even, I talk about them in the past tense. Joe and Kevin had a good run. They were great people, but they're done. You can't save everyone, Paul.
No, that's very true. Chad, as always, it's an absolute pleasure speaking with you. Thank you again for your time, your conversation, and your good humor, my friend. Take care, and we will speak soon.
Keep an eye out.